This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to our podcast where we talk about new books in media and communications. I am your host, Marcy Maserato. With me today is Nate Greenberg, Associate Professor and Program Coordinator of the Arabic Studies Program at George Mason University, who is here to talk about his book, How Information Warfare Shaped the Arab Spring, The Politics of Narrative in Tunisia and Egypt. Nate, welcome, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi, Marcy. Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, I'm really curious how you started. How did you get interested in this topic? So can you share with our listeners a little bit about your professional and educational background?
Yeah, absolutely. The backstory with this book is, I would say it's unusual. I mean, it's about a revolution, and so it sort of happened by chance. You know, I was in Egypt in 2010, 2011, doing research actually on the 1952 revolution in Egypt. It was part of my dissertation and looking at sort of cinematic responses to the 1952 revolution, the work of the Egyptian Nobel laureate Naguib Mahfouz in particular. And I had an apartment in downtown Cairo. I often joke with some of my Egyptian friends. I was living in a neighborhood called La Zogli, which is a kind of a synonym for the Ministry of Interior, which is in that neighborhood and sort of associated with a massive detention system, you know, so it's kind of a running joke, but I was living, so this neighborhood is also like three blocks from Tahrir Square. And so a couple weeks after I got, about a month after I was living there, things started to bubble up in Tunisia. And, you know, nobody thought that it was going to sort of spill over into the great event known as the Arab Spring. But, you know, following the news, watching the news, and sure enough, on the 25th of January, which is Police Day in Egypt, demonstrators take to the streets. And it, you know, it set in motion for me really a 10-year process of going back, trying to understand the events and the rhetoric that shaped the opening of the Arab uprisings. So, you know, my interest has always been in literary and rhetorical response to lived phenomena. I'm sort of trained in the Marxist humanitarian tradition, trying to understand the relationship between reality on the ground, phenomena, events on the ground as they unfold, and how writers, artists, politicians, journalists talk about it and narrate it. So I've always been interested in this kind of thematic that traverses through the book, but the core subject of the book being the uprising itself, you know, for me and for many of us, really kind of fell out of the sky, as it were.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I was very curious as I was reading, like, because I see a lot of the photos are your photos.
Yes.
So I was like, we definitely have to chat about that.
The photos are interesting, and we can get back into it later. But yeah, the cover photo that shows two guys, you know, pinning the arm of a third guy, actually kind of illustrates the whole theme of the book, which is, I guess, you know, we'll get into it, but basically how information trickles down into this kind of interpersonal lived experiences. I titled that photo Vigilantes, and, you know, that's, I have to say, I mean, it's hard to focus our minds, on something from 20 years ago, but when there's an uprising in our own nation's capital, it helps. So I would definitely have to tie that in at some point here.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you make a good point in looking at, I think it's really fascinating where you're talking about the construction of narrative and the construction of narrative and how that completely can completely derail from reality in what actually happened. And because Arab Spring is so often seen as like the social media revolution. Right. Or revolution that started through social media. Right. And, you know, we're right at that 10-year mark. So it's kind of interesting to think about this, you know, a decade in the future. So perhaps we should start, and I don't know if this makes sense to you, but maybe we can start with how is looking at the Arab Spring, like contextualizing the Arab Spring as, quote, most people know it.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good question. So, you know, I think the prevailing line now in academia and in journalism, I think we see as well in the media, has been this notion of, you know, the Arab Spring begetting an Arab winter, title of Noah Feldman's recent book to that effect. And, you know, this notion that, you know, the big push for democracy, which was spurned by social media in part, kind of created an opening for chaos in most parts of the Arab world, you know, with the possible exception of Tunisia. This is, you know, so goes the prevailing, I think, narrative on the Arab uprisings of 2010-2011. One of the points that I make in this book was that, you know, from my perspective, living in downtown Cairo, and I ended up writing about the opening, the first 2 weeks for the Seattle Times, first the Seattle Globalist, the editors there, and then they put me on to the Seattle Times, was, you know, it was from the very beginning. I mean, it was sort of chaos from the beginning. And there was no, I think that this idea that that the Arab uprisings had sort of like suddenly magically, you know, overthrown decades of dictatorship and all this, you know, that it was this the Facebook revolution, this idea. I was really seeing a lot more complexity from the beginning. I think in some respects, you know, to answer your question, still to this day, I think the big prevailing notion has been that, you know, the uprisings were fueled by social media. And I think that is true to a degree, but that the circumstances in the region, you know, you even see from the kind of more, let's say, cynical perspective among academics is that, you know, the region was never ready for democracy, was never ready for this kind of, you know, grand democratizing experiment. And so it set in motion, you know, the kind of chaotic events of civil war in Syria and Libya and Yemen, the rise of ISIS and so forth. Now not that I would dispute that, but again, but I'm interested in more of the fine details of history, I guess, than the grand sweep. And I think to challenge it a bit further, I would just say that, one of the points I try and make in this book is that I think from the very beginning, frankly, it's hard to say that it was successful. But in the case of Egypt, and one of the arguments that I make is that one of the main reasons I think that the revolution, sort of unraveled and some of the founding principles of what the early revolutionaries were trying to achieve, was unraveled in part by this very sophisticated counter communications and counter narrative campaign, counter revolutionary campaign, that was also churning through the information ecosystem at the time.
I think there's also a lot of the context that seems to be missing, and kind of what you'd mentioned, like the grand sweeping narrative that these countries are all different, right, and they had different access to social media and they used the social media differently. And it was used for both sides from what I understand.
Yeah.
And so, yes, you have a lot of these, you know, nuances in how it was done. So just kind of creating this grand narrative of, like, you know, Facebook, and you just, you know, created this whole, like, you know, let's bring democracy to these Arab nations via social media. And it's much more complex than that. because I think many of them are still very much struggling with similar issues 10 years ago today, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. And you know, I just to give flesh to this idea a little bit, you know, what I was seeing at the time, and talking to you now, it's sort of bringing it back to life a little bit. But so, you know, the uprising in Egypt, in Cairo, again, we didn't see it coming. Tunisia had been unfolding. Mohamed Bouazizi, who's now this kind of mythical figure, who lit himself on fire in the city of Sidi Bouzid on December 17th, 2010. You know, that set in motion all the protests in Tunisia and elsewhere. In Cairo, just even including close to where I was living downtown, there were imitations of the self-immolation, men setting themselves on fire. And it was this kind of strange sense that it was creeping across the border. But on the 25th, you know, it was interesting. It was not the sort of mass uprising that we now think about in retrospect. It was about 15,000 people. They are, you know, we now think that congregated, arrived in Tahrir. There was violent pushback from the police right away, but it wasn't clear that this was going to propel the end of a 30-year dictatorship. So I'm in my apartment. Fiance at the time had actually she'd never been to the Middle East, and she got on a plane from Seattle on January 26th, so a day after the protest started. And I remember we spoke on the phone. She was in Vancouver, and I said on transfer, she said, "You know, what's going on? I'm seeing on CNN that there's protests on, you know, in Egypt." I said, "No, you know, it doesn't look like it's going to be anything big. You know, it's fine. No, you know, no restrictions." So she gets there. The next day basically is January 28th, which becomes known as the Day of Rage, the Jumma al-Ghadab, Friday of Rage. And this was the day that the Muslim Brotherhood joined the protests. You know, they had sort of, out of respect, interestingly, for the anniversary of the police day, which was January 25th. Historically, the Muslim Brotherhood had actually lost... They had lost members in early fighting. On the police day was named after an anniversary of an early conflict between the British along the Suez Canal in the days of decolonization back in the late 40s, I believe, early 50s. So the Brotherhood, interestingly, you know, they had fought alongside Egyptian police that were besieged by the British in Ismailia, which is a Brotherhood stronghold. So they historically recognized the police day to some extent. So they didn't participate on the 25th. On the 28th, the Brotherhood comes and it just pops off and it becomes this giant, you know, really what we now think of as the occupation of Tahrir, the shutdown of the city. It was also at this time that there was a information blackout that was imposed. And that included taking Al Jazeera off the air, shutting down the internet, turning off cell phones. I write about in the book, I went back and found the exact moment that the internet was shut down. I was in the middle of shooting off an email to these editors in Seattle that I was working with and saying, "Hey, the internet is kind of chopping in and out. Just in case, here's a landline from my apartment." And it was like the last email I sent out before the internet went down. And, so it became very chaotic, and there was looting. There was, you know, quite a lot of violence, Molotov cocktails being thrown from adjacent rooftops to where we were living. And, you know, but one of the, but it was a discernible shift. I mean, you could tell a kind of the rhetoric that was passing around, you know, that was in the streets. I was hanging out at this coffee shop this whole time, which kind of operated incognito behind shuttered doors and meeting with locals and talking. And, you know, it had flipped from this kind of from a protest, you know, what they were talking about as a intifada, even a kind of an uprising, to Thauda, to a full scale revolution. And so it was really building, but at the same time, already fomenting was this kind of counter revolutionary rhetoric. And I remember the moment really almost specifically was a few days after the U.S. Embassy had evacuated everybody. We were still there. You know, I was trying to do some reporting basically from Tahrir, interviewing some people. And one of the guys in this neighborhood that I had been in touch with were out walking, and it was, you know, it was nighttime. I was trying to get to the apartment of this German guy that I had was friends with and hadn't been in touch with since things started. And so this young guy, Mohammed, was walking me through the neighborhood because every neighborhood had set up these kind of checkpoints from almost block to block. And he said, you know, Nate, you got to be careful now because everybody's saying that all of this is happening because of the CIA, because of Americans, you know.
Oh,
and
wow.
it was like right there that I go, you know, and that was not present in the first, you know, first couple of days, first week almost.
So what brought that about then, do you think?
That's what launched this book. That's really the book and all of my subsequent research, because I've been, you know, we ended up leaving a group of guys that I had known, you know, that I'd been hanging out with for months, you know, including some ex military officials who lived in this apartment block where I lived. It's actually right around the corner from the famed Jacobean building, if you know that novel. You know, they came, it was like February 3rd. It was right after the battle, so-called Battle of the Camels, pounding on my door at 3 in the morning, you know, 3:30 in the morning. My fiance is, you know, Liz, she's at this time, my wife, she was scared out of her mind. You know, I was like, what the is going on here?
Yeah, I can only imagine.
Right? I mean, it's like 3:30 in the morning. Yeah. And by the way, the police have been disbanded and there's like no clear, you know, legal, like security apparatus. It's like the military are in, the police are gone. I mean, so it was nuts. And, you know, so I opened the door and I know these guys, right? These are guys I've been hanging out with for months, smoking shisha with and talking, you know, and they're very polite, but they're like, I had told Muhammad the night before, this kid that I mentioned, or the night before, like 2 nights before, I said, you know, I think we're going to leave. And I think that sort of triggered a kind of suspicion on their part. So they came to the door, three thirty in the morning, pounding on the door. And they say, you know, Nate, we got to see your passport. You know, it's for your own safety. You know, show us your paper, show us your passport. And I mean, it was clear that they had become suspicious. Everybody was suspicious that, you know, an American in the area was, you know, part of some, you know, this covert clandestine operation to incite, you know, the overthrow of the government. I mean, that was so, I mean, I kind of like gingerly kind of held the passport open and, you know, sort of showed them a few pages and we just, you know, we closed the door. I got it, you know, closed the door and, we were gone the next morning. We kind of snuck out, you know, 4:35 in the morning, took a taxi to the airport and just tried to get a plane. I mean, we were spooked, but so, yeah. So for me, it was like, what happened? How did it go? You know, why did this turn against, I mean, it really felt like it turned against me in a way, you know,
it sounds like you went from friend to foe to like,
yeah,
target.
Exactly. And it was like, and so I think on a very personal level, you know, for years I've been thinking about like how, what happened? Like, how did that happen? You know? And so I started writing this book, really getting into the writing of it. I did two other books, you know, sort of in advance, and I'd sort of been putting this off. I mean, I kind of always felt like this was a book that I was going to write at some point, that I was going to get into, but I'd been putting it off in part because it was really wound up with so much kind of personal, like, anxiety in a way, you know, like, had I missed, you know, like, I, so part of me wishes that I had stayed even longer, you know, and then part of me has always been like, well, this was clearly not our place to be, you know, as an American, it wasn't our revolution. It wasn't our place. And the journalists that were like descending on it, you know, were, I seemed kind of vulturous to me. And so, but then it was also this main question of like, what turned these guys against me, you know? And so I started writing this book in basically 2016. And the 2016 presidential election. And we're learning more and more about this kind of misinformation, disinformation, trolls and bots and all this kind of stuff that we now have learned, you know, so much about. And I started thinking to myself, you know, like, God, a lot of this rhetoric is the same. A lot of the rhetoric that was kind of surrounding the early Trump campaign was this like virulent animosity towards the globalists, you know, George Soros, CIA, this kind of, you know, Western conspiracy for democracy, you know, Western conspiracy and all this kind of stuff, liberal democratic conspiracies. I mean, there was that sort of vibe has kind of always been around the Trumpism, or, and it was in 2016, we could see it. And I went back, and I started looking at some of the early news I had saved. One of the things I had done was I grabbed the local newspapers, from like every day of the uprising when I was there. You know, I said the internet was shut down. Satellite TV, Al Jazeera was taken off. So the newspapers was really, and I have a chapter dedicated to it in the book. The newspapers were really like suddenly became really relevant for people like living in Cairo and in Egypt.
Yeah, that's super fascinating. And yeah. it's great that you had the idea to take those on a daily basis.
Yeah, it was like, you know, I was doing this kind of like blow by blow thing for the Seattle Times and kind of talking, but I was also in my mind thinking, you know, someday clearly this is going to be this is history in the making. So, right. So I was kind of like I was collecting those. So I had this huge pile in my office in Fairfax, you know, of all these newspapers from like the first 2 weeks of the uprising in Egypt. And so I started going back into them and I was remembering, I was recalling, you know, things really changed on January 29th, which was the moment that the military was called in. It was the day after the Brotherhood arrived. It was the Friday of Rage. The police are disbanded. Like that was a pivotal, that was like a really pivotal moment where it sort of shifted from the sort of quote unquote Facebook youth, you know, and the rhetoric around those guys was interesting too. They were like very clearly identified with like a neighborhood in Cairo, Heliopolis, as like upper class, you know, rich kids. That was the rhetoric I was hearing from people in like downtown Cairo, you know. And the Facebook, it was kind of non-threatening. It was kind of like, whatever. It's kind of this experiment, you know, it's a social movement thing, but it's not populist. Anyhow, that shifted on the 28th. And so I went back and I looked at the major state-run newspaper from the 29th. It's Ahram, for some of your listeners will know it. Al-Ahram is the oldest state-run newspaper in the Arab world. And it's always been understood as sort of an organ of the government in Egypt. And so on the inside, you know, like the sort of one of the main cover stories, you know, from the 29th is a headline. It's in Arabic and I'm looking at it. It says it's something to the effect of, you know, secret U.S. conspiracy to overthrow the government. And in the article I later found out it's a translation from, it's an exact translation from an article that appeared in the Aftenposten in Norway of all places. And it was a leak. It was a WikiLeaks article that had been farmed out to the Aftenposten in Norway. And it was from the so-called Cablegate of 2008, which was when WikiLeaks gained access to, you know, volumes of confidential memos that had been sent from members of the U.S. diplomatic corps. So, you know, the ambassador to Egypt Margaret Scobie, who I ended up interviewing for this book, a lot of her emails, they were not emails, I forget what they call them. They're sort of telegrams. It's a system that the State Department uses, but, you know, confidential, highly secure memos that had been sort of grabbed, hacked by WikiLeaks, and then were farmed out. And you'll remember this. This was in 2010, and it created all these huge diplomatic scandals. You know, Hillary Clinton was all over it, sort of panicking as Secretary of State. And it was right. All about, you know, all these diplomatic relationships that were blowing up because there was all this sort of insider talk about, you know, what American diplomats, you know, really felt or what the, you know, about their, you know, about their counterparts. Right. So, but one of the things that's interesting here, WikiLeaks, on the eve of the Friday of Rage, farmed out to a select group of news organizations, including, I believe, it was CNN, New York Times, Aftenposten in Norway, and the Daily Telegraph in London. They farmed out, or they gave, what I've later understood is that they had contacted the editors and then gave them access to the leaks at this basically specific scheduled time on the eve of the Friday of Rage, on the eve of the day that was going to launch the big revolutionary, that did launch the big revolutionary moment. But they planted at this time these leaks, and the leaks were from like 2008, 2009, you know, years before. Mm-hmm. But so one of them that I found was, so there was the one in Ahram that was about, it was a memo from Scobie, I believe the ambassador to Egypt, talking about, the funding, US funding of NGOs in Egypt that were like promoting democracy. And there was like a figure, it was like $140 million. And actually, I think the $140 million was in the headline of this, translated into Arabic of this article. And so, and then I was like, well, that's interesting. Cause it really, what it does is it sort of like colored the revolutionaries, right? It made it look like, you know, this, the possible, like, well, wait, is this organic? Is this an organic uprising? Is it a youth driven revolution, or is the US somehow involved? So I go back. So I keep looking around. I'm like, is this a thing? Was this really going on with WikiLeaks, you know, farming out these leaks, you know, concerning U.S. funding for NGOs, pro-democracy or whatever? The Daily Telegraph publishes at the same time on the eve of the revolution. It comes out, I think, you know, around midnight on the eve of the Friday of Rage article, which I feature this on the back of the book. It says, you know, secret U.S. I'm going to read it exactly. Egypt protests, America's secret backing for rebel leaders behind uprising. And so in the article, it talks about, you know, how there had been members of the April 6th movement, which was kind of one of the vanguard groups of the protests, had attended workshops in DC in 2008. I don't know. They actually, I think in this article, well, it led to the arrest of one member of the April 6th group, immediately, but it's this idea. They took a memo from Margaret Scobie from 2008 in which she basically says, you know, yeah, the April 6th group, I met with them and they're going to go to these workshops and they want to meet with, you know, other people, so-and-so, Al-Baradei, who was a major opposition figure. And they want to organize, protest, to sort of show up in the streets, and to stop basically what was known as the secession plan, or this idea that Mubarak was going to pass on the presidency to his son. So from 2008, but now here it is featured in a major international newspaper, and right, it's kind of this, so it's like building this sort of stigma, and I'm thinking, this is really strange. And I just happened to be looking down, and there's like 2,500 comments or something on this article. And I'll go through the comments and the rhetoric. Now, this is summer of 2016 when I'm doing this and writing this. and I'm going through it and the comments, I'm seeing all these comments like, this is what we get. The CIA trying to overthrow the Egyptian government. George Soros, you know, George Soros and the globalists, you know, are trying to install democracy in Egypt. And this is some of the rhetoric, some of these kind of keywords that were around the Trump campaign 2016. I'm like, God, this is weird. And so I look at one of the commentators or a couple of the commentators and I started to do this kind of deep dive. You know, I went into the rabbit hole or whatever, tracing some of these commentators from this, you know, this Daily Telegraph article from 2011 on the eve of the Friday of Rage. And a handful of them, I noticed, had like 50,000, 60,000, 70,000 comments across different platforms, an impossible number up until that time, 2016. So like within 5 years, they had this like impossible number of like comments across different media platforms. One of them I focus on in the book went by the name Tropic Girl. And Tropic Girl was, I've since learned, a troll who appears in 2016 pumping the same kind of misinformation around the Trump campaign that we now know as sort of historical fact, you know, appearing on publications like The Hill, Breitbart News, and always kind of pumping the same narrative, you know, like that. And it was really demonizing Hillary Clinton in 2016. It was, you know, Clinton is a member of the Brotherhood. Obama's a Brotherhood member. You know, Clinton is secretly working with, you know, George Soros and all these kind of things. So in other words, the same disinformation strategy and in all likelihood, the same organization, the IRA, the Internet Research Agency, was operating at the opening salvo of the Arab uprisings in 2011. That has been something that analysts are looking at. I spoke with a senior analyst at the RAND Corps about this, who confirmed my own suspicion when he looked at the information, spoke with the ambassador, the American ambassador in Egypt at this time. And it really, in a way, it pushes back our understanding of Russia's global strategy. It's typically been identified with 2014 in the Crimea incident. But I think as it's clear, and I make the case occasionally in this book, but I'm really pursuing it more aggressively now after this book, since having done some subsequent interviews, that Russia was deeply invested. The Kremlin was deeply invested in shifting the narrative of the Arab uprisings, trying to undermine the pro-democracy narrative in Egypt, in Syria, in Libya, and to subvert the struggle for democracy with the conspiracy of a Western plot to instill these kind of, you know, puppet, you know, pro-Western puppet regimes around the region. And so it sounds like anyways, that's kind of conspiracy. It's a lot. Yeah, I told you I could go on. So I'll stop.
No, I think.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
So when you're writing this book and in reading this book, yeah. I thought it was interesting that you really do bring, you know, you bring in Frederick Jameson, you talk even about like Difference, you know, Jacques Derrida and Walter Benjamin and kind of bring in these scholars in terms of really looking at the narrative and how the narrative is problematic. And that narrative, is when we're looking at whether it's the political narrative, there's multiple different narratives that are being constructed. So can you talk a little bit more about how you see that narrative being problematic, both in terms of what you just mentioned on the greater political sphere, like, oh, hey, this is the West, right? It's the CIA. Mm-hmm. And also on the ground, kind of like with your experience with your friends that all of a sudden
mm-hmm.
turned on you and targeted you, right? Yeah. So there's multiple narratives there. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, part of it, it was just part of the book is this kind of, I mean, first of all, there's all these different case studies. So like the book, you know, the issue about WikiLeaks and the counter narrative, counter revolution, that's kind of like one slice of the book, but you're absolutely right. I mean, the main thread that connects this book is narrative and, you know, to what extent does narrative alter or transform reality to reinforce or propel certain ideological alliances. This was something I had looked at. I had done a postdoc in strategic communications, and so, you know, and I'm very interested in how actually I think it's kind of an irony that despite the cacophony of the internet age, or rather, in a sense, even because the cacophony of the internet age, this the kind of information overload that everybody is subject to, the sense of all these kind of multiple lines of information, what prevails through the cacophony are these big, bold, clear narratives. And so one of the things that and that does play into, Jameson has a great quote from it's from his book Marxism and Form, which came out in the early 70s, soon after the May 68 events of May 68, and he says something to the effect of revolution, times of revolution create narratable events. It's the kind of unraveling of our daily routines, really, in a way, the sense of a kind of clear-cut path for a nation and even for individuals when that's kind of thrown up for grabs. I mean, we're experiencing this, I think, as Americans and actually really around the world with COVID, definitely. But when things are really sort of scrambled in a sense, when the way that we've known the world to be all of a sudden seems to be not available, like it's up for grabs. It's in those moments that narrative can really grab hold of the imagination to kind of reorder our understanding of reality and to show a way forward, in a sense. Narrative and the basic concept of narrative that I work with really comes out of, I mean, Jameson, also Ricoeur, Paul Ricoeur, and this idea that Ricoeur makes the point that, you know, narrative is a sequence of beginning, middles, and ends. I mean, full stop. That's it. It's about ordering reality into a clear sequence of time. Add protagonists and antagonists, and we have this kind of fabrication of reality that allows the mind to grab hold of it. So as a literary person coming out of literature studies, that's kind of what we always do when we're looking at works of fiction. But I wanted to apply that to public discourse, to the public sphere, to different forms of media. And so, yes, using Jameson, Ricoeur, Derrida, Difference, again, in the sense here, I mean, Derrida kind of takes it in a different direction if we're talking theory, I suppose, but the idea that Difference, that, you know, that trying to, you know, label or, you know, name something for what it is, that it kind of, it makes it you're deferring its attainable meaning by trying to categorize it, by trying to name it. I mean, that's my off the cuff description.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. Yeah. I think it all of this is basically turning into a Hollywood film that has a beginning, middle, and end.
Totally. Yeah.
Right. So that's what Jameson talks about, and this idea of difference is that the meaning is always different and deferred. So you can
be
like chasing something that you're never going to find.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Which is problematic. I mean, they're both, it's problematic to really box things in, but then how do you explain to the globally what was happening?
You know,
you have something like Arab Spring. Oh, that sounds interesting, because then it goes to talk about the Prague Spring, right? What was happening in Czechoslovakia and in 68 in Paris. And so like we as in society, it's easily to digest that information. And then of course, you know, then we have fake news, which has been around, well, since information's been around, but sure. It has like now it's we identify, it's there. It's like now it has a title.
Yeah, I think, yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, again, I've used the Arab Spring in this book as a way to kind of crystallize how narrative is affecting, sort of lived experience in the information age and also geopolitical dynamics. I think in sort of like stepping up, going, you know, from the bird's eye view, looking back on this project and kind of where I'm moving now, I spoke with the Undersecretary for State for Public Diplomacy at the time. He was there from 2008-2009, James Glassman, and he was the one that had built this idea of what was called Public Diplomacy 2.0. The theory here from the State Department was to convene bloggers. And so, see, here's the thing. There's an element of truth. And that's what's so important about, I think, disinformation and the power of narrative is that it builds on elements of truth, right? To take it in a direction, to take that information in a clear ideological direction. Public Diplomacy 2.0 was a thing. It did bring bloggers to DC. It did convene them. It did give them some workshops and some training on how to conduct social media operations, how to build networks, how to even get people in the street. And, you know, I spoke to him afterwards and I said, you know, do you feel like, I mean, can you claim, did you ever feel like you could claim some kind of victory, that there was success in a way, that you had helped put together these social media networks that did indeed, you know, spark in a way, launch the protests. I mean, certainly this is the case with Tunisia. And I don't think we have time to get into Tunisia too much here. But I mean, I think very clearly in the case of Tunisia, the cyber dissidents were really on the ground organizing events, and men and, you know, core members had indeed received some training in DC. But the philosophy, and I write about in the book, in the sub chapter called Department of Structuralism, in reference to the Department of State, had been this idea, you know, DOS department. So anyways, had been this idea of empowering people to tell their own stories, stepping back, not labeling, not claiming, not owning the narrative, but just empowering bloggers to tell their own story. And it really actually coalesced, I think, explicitly with Obama's philosophy of leading from behind. It was this idea of putting bloggers out front, empowering new voices. They worked with a group called, there was members of a group called Global Voices, which was bought out by Reuters and was on the ground to begin with. And there was, you know, these networks of bloggers. So this idea of just letting people tell their own stories and creating a kind of pluralistic narrative in a sense. So not a fixed sort of like, you know, fixed narrative that's sort of a centralized narrative, but rather this kind of like scattershot, buckshot, multiple perspectives, multiple voices. You know, the critique has always been about the dissidents, the cyber dissidents, the bloggers, that it wasn't clear what their vision was. It wasn't clear what their philosophy was. They were just kind of anti-censorship, you know, anti-police violence. And, you know, there was this. So one of the big critiques has been that they didn't have a kind of vision, a philosophy to organize around. Flip to the other side, to the counter revolutionary narrative that emerges, as I show in the very opening days of protests, with WikiLeaks pumping, reframing information from 2008, and the troll armies, most likely part of the IRA, pumping a very specific and ultimately centralized narrative that has been deployed around the globe. This idea, which was deployed against Hillary Clinton by the Trump campaign, that there is a sort of secret globalist cabal, you know, it's anti-Semitic, there was information operations surrounding the Black Lives Movement as well, to the same effect. That very consistent counter-narrative, which we now know has been fueled primarily by the Kremlin and deployed against social movements around the globe. That's that kind of singular, bold narrative that seems to cut through the cacophony. And I think, sadly, one of the big takeaways from the Arab Spring has been, or one of the big results of the Arab Spring, which I think it's parallel to, but different from this idea of an Arab winter, is the Russian pivot. The now dominant presence of Russia in the Middle East, the profound alliance now with Russia and Syria, which was known, but also Egypt, what we see them doing in Libya, the relationship between the Kremlin and Saudi and the Emiratis collaborate. I mean, so, and the US meanwhile, just completely like taken out of the picture, you know, in part because of this active, you know, proactive withdrawal and, you know, and the Trumpism and protectionism and all that. Anyway, so it does come down to narrative, I think, in the sense. And I have a kind of a cynical vision of how narrative functions in the information age. And I think we're seeing this play out now in Africa. I think the French are picking up. They're trying to mimic the Russian strategy of fabricating fabricating information, fabricating news to create more bolder counter narratives that will cut through the cacophony of the information age. So that's kind of been my headspace with this book.
Yeah. So in terms of looking at the narrative, I mean, do you think, and you mentioned him before, and you start the book talking about Mohamed Bouazizi and how he set himself on fire at the end of 2010. And certainly, you know, he became highly symbolic for, you know, and a catalyst for kind of the events.
Definitely.
How do you see this kind of narrative fitting in perhaps with the idea that, quote, people want or need a hero? So again, absolutely, going back into like the Hollywood, the hero's journey, the protagonist, the antagonist.
That strikes right at the heart of it, Marcy. And I think that's really, I see the Bouazizi, the myth of Bouazizi, as one of like the most important narratives to come out of the Arab Spring. And it's the origin story, right, of the Arab Spring in many ways. And it was one of the big success stories for the cyber dissidents. This was a case. This was a Mohamed Bouazizi. The story that became his story was really birthed by the cyber dissident network. You had on the ground in Sidi Bouzid, Sofiane Chorabi, who raced up to Tunis on the night after Bouazizi lit himself on fire with a flash drive because there was a media blackout imposed on Sidi Bouzid. And he's putting his information up online onto Facebook. And then you have Bouazizi's cousin who goes onto Facebook and it kind of gets, and the story of him lighting himself on fire gets picked up by the new media desk at Al Jazeera, which included Yasmin Ryan, who was a reporter for Al Jazeera English, who was the first one to kind of break the story on the organizing effect of the cyber dissidents. And she interviews Sofiane Chorabi and she interviews Lina Benmeheni. Lina Benmeheni was part of the cyber dissident collective of the Tunisians. She's associated with the group Global Voices, the group Nawat. And Benmeheni writes a post on Global Voices that was the earliest full description of Bouazizi's martyrdom. And she includes in this post for Global Voices, which comes out just a couple days after he lights himself on fire, a description of him being a university graduate. We since learned that that was not true. I mean, he was actually a high school dropout. But the inclusion of that factoid, I suggest, was really important because it suggested a kind of classic Aristotelian tragedy, this kind of fall, you know, somebody who had worked hard, who was, you know, he had gotten a college degree and he couldn't get a job. And it sort of grabbed the attention, I think, of a lot of like-minded organizers on social media that really sort of captured the heartstrings. And Lina Benmeheni, later talked about how it was that, you know, it was this idea that he was a university graduate that, because other people had killed themselves in Sidi Bouzid. It had happened before. There had been other similar protests before. And she said, but it was this factoid that he had been a university graduate that really sort of like mobilized her generation, you know, striking this emotional chord. And, you know, one of the reasons that I can't let this let our episode here end without mentioning that three of those names that I just referred to, Lina Ben Meheni, Sofian Shorabi, and Yasmin Ryan, have now all died. And all in their late 30s. Wow. The Sofian Shorabi was one of the people that had been identified as having attended the DC workshops. Lina Ben Meheni also was a Fulbright to the United States 2008, 2009, and had been part of the Alliance for Youth Summit, the workshops, to some extent. I don't know the full details. They were virulently attacked by trolls, the counter-revolutionary narrative that was flowing from the Kremlin, flowing from the old regimes to demonize the bloggers as U.S.-backed, even though, you know, their backing was minimal at best. Anyhow, so the circumstances of their deaths are different. Ben Meheni, we think, died from complications. I guess from what I understand, it's complications surrounding organ transplant. Sofian Shorabi was abducted in Libya. And we don't know what happened to him. And Yasmin Ryan fell off a building in Istanbul a couple years ago to mysterious circumstances. She had been the Al Jazeera reporter that had reported on the cyber dissidents. Well, they reported, she quoted some of the cyber dissidents, but reported on Ben Ali, the Tunisian regime's blackout strategy and media crackdown strategy. So, you know, it's kind of all mysterious, and it does lend itself again. And also that's the other thing, when there's so much information around and all these different kind of things, you don't, you know, one, I including myself here, you don't know what reality to grab onto. And it's easy to grab onto conspiracy theories and big, bold narratives. So try to be cognizant of that as well.
I agree, because you have these, this is where postmodernism comes in, right? Where they're just like, oh, we have these grand meta narratives that claim to profess one universal truth. And well, that's it's far more complex than that, because there could be, you know, we could argue that truth is relative and contextual. And I think, you know, like with my students, when I've taught journalism in the past, that's a common question that they have, that they legitimately want to know how to, you know, or they want to know like what the right media is to consume. And they're just exhausted. They're just like, I don't want the left, I don't want the right. Can we just have like neutral news, like news that just reports the news? So I think they just get exhausted. I think as society, we get exhausted as to like, well, yeah, these are all narratives. Which one do we listen to? What's real? What's not real? And the Arab Spring is such a perfect example of something that can just go in so many different directions. It's a very complex thing, but can really, it can really have this, you know, all these multiple narratives that in some ways, I think, they can actually be detrimental to the cause as well as helpful to it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You end the book. I mean, we barely scratched the surface. Your book is extremely rich, but I think it's interesting that you do kind of bring it around and you end the book on a note about fiction.
Yeah.
And about film and narrative. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. The last chapter, deals with, specifically fictional genres. And you're absolutely right. It is, the idea was to sort of, you know, throughout the book, I'm looking at the fictionalization of reality in a sense, the degree to which, you know, narrative has grabbed hold of reality and filtered it into these kind of ideological platforms, ideological alliances. But with the end of the book, I wanted to look at fiction specifically, and one of this kind of new fictional genres that really takes off after the Arab Spring, which is science fiction. So the history of science fiction in the Arab world is very interesting. It's a very short history, but it became this interesting kind of like point of synthesis, I think, looking at Arabic science fiction, in particular the work of really the most popular writer in Egypt, a man named Ahmed Khalid Tawfiq, who died recently in 2018. Because much of his fiction, first of all, his most famous book is this novel called Utopia, which is this incredible kind of genre-bending sort of horror sci-fi. It's about a future Cairo that's kind of split into two worlds between a rich upper-class enclave of heavily drugged cannibals, basically, who descend on the old Cairo and the world of the others to hunt for body parts as these kind of tokens. And it's extremely dark. But running through that novel and some of his subsequent novels is this very cynical approach to technology, this very cynical approach to, in particular, sort of like social media technology, communications technology, the sense that in science fiction of Ahmed Khalid Tawfiq, and actually I found it throughout the short history of Egyptian science fiction in particular, has been this kind of cynicism, this fear of imported new technologies, the association of those imported new technologies with, you know, Western conspiracies, and the sense that that they create this kind of detachment from lived experience and, you know, offer all these kind of, fantastic and horrific, futures in which, you know, people that what his novel that comes out after the Arab Spring, which is called Mytho Icarus or Like Icarus. It has not been translated. And that's something that needs to happen. But it's about a man who, not unlike the internet, in his brain gains this kind of infinite access to infinite knowledge, infinite wisdom. And he's goes back in time and into the future, kind of solving problems. But he also is driven insane by it, by this kind of information overload. And so I thought that it was a fitting way to kind of close out this book. The fictionalization or the actual fictional engagement with the perceived fictionalization of reality that is the information age.
Yeah, I agree. I think it was really, as somebody who studies and teaches film, I definitely appreciate talking about the narrative throughout your book and certainly kind of ending on that and seeing that there's so many of these narratives, like fictional narratives, and that are, you know, film is so dominated by the West. But we forget how much richness in fictional narratives there are outside of the West. So much. That's great. Well, Nate, we've taken up a lot of your time, but as we wrap up, I'm curious to know, I think you briefly mentioned, what are you currently working on? What's next for you after this?
Well, I've got an article coming out now called American Spring. And I just, to my great chagrin, I just noticed that that's a trending on Twitter. But, you know, it's always the case. You submit an article a month ago and all of a sudden it's trending on Twitter. But the trending on Twitter is relating to the siege of the Capitol, which is wrongheaded. That's the counter-revolution. We're seeing what we saw in the Capitol is, I think, in some respects, a response to the Black Lives Matter movement of the summer. So I have an article coming out looking at how Russian state media in particular spun the Black Lives Matter movement through their vast media apparatus in the Arab world, the Arabic speaking media apparatus of the from the Russian state, RT and Sputnik. And staying on this topic from the book, in the sense that, you know, I'm the election of Donald Trump pissed me off, like a lot of us. and I'm in the camp that feels that he was aided and abetted tremendously by the Kremlin. So I'm staying focused on this issue, and so that's the main thing. I'm also working on a new book with a colleague, Waleed Mahdi, Looking at also going back a little bit and looking at U.S. Counter-communication strategy in the war on terror and some of the digital networks that came out of the counterterrorism campaigns from the mid-noughts. So those books, and then, I don't know, I'm a comparative literature person by training, so I'm always all over the place. I'm doing this media stuff, the security stuff, and I really want to do a translation, you know, of some obscure Arabic novel, maybe Ahmed Khaled Tawfiq's Myth of Icarus, but
Awesome. Yeah, well, great. You're keeping busy. Keep me posted on your next book publication, then we can have you back on and chat with you again. So it sounds really very unique approach to the book, you know, having the personal experience and the academic experience. So thank you again for joining us, Nate.
Marcy, thanks so much. Yeah.
Yeah, it was really awesome chatting with you. And thank you all for listening, everyone. Until next time, cheers.
Cheers.